31. I don't remember feeling gravity's return or hitting the floor. I barely remember colliding with the ceiling, but I don't think that's what knocked me unconscious. My head hurts, but not concussion bad, which is good. I'm not sure how many whacks to the head I can handle in one day without becoming a useless lump. I'm lying on my side, head on my arm, sore but alive. I open my eyes and find Cassie lying beside me, eyes closed. For a moment, I imagine this is a lazy Saturday morning, that we're waking up together, that we're more than friends, and I think we are now. Maybe. The moment is broken when groans from the hallway beyond the closed door reach my ears. I stretch out and place my fingers against the side of her neck. I don't immediately find her pulse, but I don't need to. My touch makes her eyes flutter and open. "Okay?" I ask. She grunts, pushing herself up. "Think so."
"How in the name of Captain Crunch's testes did I wind up on the floor?"
Kuzneski asks. His back is on the floor, but his legs jut straight up against the bed. He leans to the side and flops over.
"Wait, now I remember. I was fucking flying. Again."
"Again?" Flores says, sitting up on the top bunk opposite Langdon, who is exactly where I last saw him, still clinging to the bed. When Kuzneski sees Flores has been spared the pain of being dropped down onto the hard floor, he says,
"Seriously? How lucky is this asshole?"
Not very, I think, but I keep the observation to myself. If his story is true, he came to Synergy to stop Langdon from unleashing hell on Earth. Instead, he got swept up in it and lost all his friends, including future me and Cassie, in the process.
"The effect was far more powerful this time," Langdon says. "Before, it lifted us a few feet off the ground, but nothing like this, if not for the ceiling."
He looks up, no doubt imagining the sky above. "Will it be like that for everyone?" I ask, concerned for Enola, not to mention the layers of people in Black Creek. Langdon shakes his head. "We're at the epicenter. Whatever is happening in the collider, it's directly below Synergy. Here we experience it as an eruption of space-time. On the mountainside, it would be more like a pyroclastic flow of bending space-time as it races outward."
"Sounds about right," Cassie says.
"But I can't imagine what we just felt would react gently with the world beyond Synergy," Langdon says. "Any ideas why that one was more intense?" Flores asks. Langdon pales a bit.
"A more powerful flux."
Kuzneski pushes himself up.
"Meaning?"
"A larger flux." I look to the walls, expecting to see windows, but find none. I don't remember any in the outer hall either. Whenever we are, it's beyond the dawn of civilization in the Americas. At this point, I'm not sure it matters how far back we go. It's possible there are still Cherokee tribes about, but if the jumps continue to grow, we'll eventually predate the human migration that brought people out of Africa, across Asia, and down to the Americas via Russia and Alaska, if that's how it actually happened. In this universe, our band of time travelers might become the very first Americans. The question is why? Why go back at all? Why take all these people? Why risk playing with science as powerful as the God and devil particles? Part of the answer comes in a moment of realization. My Dr. Langdon is here, but Jacqueline is nowhere to be seen. Future Langdon has reclaimed his wife a year before her death. But why would he do that? Unless he has a cure, I think. Something from the future that would have saved her now. That will save her now. But even if he manages to save her, his mind won't be restored. You don't create a robotic army, slay dozens of people, and tear an entire community through space-time if there is a shred of sanity left in you. But I understand his motivation. I already decided to save my father from his fate in the mine, to change time for my own selfish gain. I wouldn't have sacrificed an entire town, but I was willing to risk the unknown consequences of altering the past. Now that I know we're in a new dimension of time-space, I can protect my father free of guilt. But that doesn't absolve me of being willing to take the risk. And it doesn't absolve future Langdon for what he's done. Thinking of my father, I yank open the door and find myself facing a room full of people in various states of recovery. Some are still unconscious, being tended to by those who have already woken up.
The segregation I find when I first entered has evaporated. People are helping who they can, whether or not they come from the same nationality, tribe, or time. My father is being tended to by one of the older Cherokee women. He's got a good gash on his head, either from hitting the ceiling or the floor on the way back down. Owen looks no worse for the wear, crouching beside Dad.
"That was a big one," he says when he spots me approaching.
"Dad okay?" I ask him.
"Fine," my father says. "You learn anything interesting?"
"Nothing that will put you at ease," I tell him, "but a plan is coming together." The Cherokee woman removes her hand from the bandage on his head and lifts his hand up to hold it.
"Thank you," he says to her, receiving a nod in return before she moves on to help others. Then he turns back to me.
"Something dangerous, I reckon?"
"Just sitting around is dangerous," Owen says.
"Hopefully not for much longer," I tell him. It's wishful thinking. Our plan is really just a bullet point list of goals, completely devoid of how to make them happen. But it's a start. The problem is that offering everyone unrealistic hope doesn't seem honest enough. Not for my formerly deceased father and my younger self.
"You should know, this is permanent."
"Living in this place?"
Owen asks, looking around the cramped quarters. "Living in the past," I say. "We might be able to stop our backward progress, but we can't undo it." Both of them take the news a bit better than I was expecting. My father takes my hand.
"Near as I can tell, we have just about everything we had back home."
"Even more,"
Owen says, smiling up at me.
"If all of us survive."
"Listen, we need to..."
"Upsy-daisy, asshole,"
Kuzneski says. His tone throws me for a moment until I realize it's coming from the main door rather than from the bedroom. I nearly rush him. This is the moment we've been waiting for. But he's armed with an assault rifle, as are the men flanking him. Between them, there is enough firepower to cut down every man, woman, and child behind me.
"What do you want?"
I ask, standing my ground.
"It's not what I want, it's what the big man wants."
Future Kuzneski points a finger at me. "And right now, that is you." When I don't move or respond, he adds,
"Don't make me or else, you man."
I glance back to the bedroom door, where Cassie and younger Kuzneski are watching. The two Kuzneskis flip each other off. Same gesture, same timing. Their synchronicity seems to annoy both of them.
"Now,"
future Kuzneski says, but I still don't budge until Cassie gives me a nod. There's no choice. We both know it. I turn to Owen, say, "Take care of your old man." And then I give our father a smile. And with that, I head for the door, arms raised. I'm fully expecting to be bound, but future Kuzneski just turns and heads for the door, allowing me to follow him, flanked by the two guards. Again, I could attack. Disarming the men and shooting Kuzneski in the back would take seconds. But then what? I'm not being roughed up or mistreated. If future Langdon saw me as a threat, I'd certainly be in chains. He's not a fool. Despite my future self being at odds with a man, I have yet to tip my hand. If his impression of my current self is different to that of my future self, well, maybe he thinks I'll toe the line. And I reckon I'll let him go right on thinking that until I decide to pop him in the face and stop this crazy train through time in its tracks. I'm led down the hall toward the door through which I entered the building. Kuzneski stops by a door and opens it to reveal a closet. He slips into a winter jacket before tossing one to each of the men behind me.
"Colder than a Yeti's taint out there."
Rather than offering me a coat, he closes the closet door and exits the building. Arctic air rolls through the open door, flooding the hallway. It's cold enough to take my breath away, burning my exposed skin. Just a few minutes in this frigid air will do permanent damage. Part of me wants to be the tough guy and step out into the cold, put on a show of strength by resisting its effects. But I'm not fighting for my pride here. I'm fighting for the people in this building and at Adele's base. I need to play it smart, and that means not losing my fingers. I yank open the closet and pull out a jacket for myself.
"Hey,"
one of the guards grumbles. He flinches back when I give him a death glare and say, "Try to stop me." Kuzneski has a good laugh at the guard's expense, but it's short-lived. His teeth are already chattering.
Fuck, it's cold. Let's go already.
Blinding white light stuns me for a moment. The late afternoon sun blazes down through a deep blue sky, reflecting off a 5-foot-tall wall of snow surrounding Synergy's perimeter. The amount of snow on its own is strange, even for an Appalachian mountaintop in the middle of winter. But it's made more dramatic by the lack of trees. The forest is missing. Kuzneski notes my attention on our surroundings and says,
"Welcome to the Ice Age, asshole!"